From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. A national debate continues to churn over how to house the tens of thousands of undocumented children from Central America in federal custody. We talk about the response in Maryland with Bill McCarthy, head of Catholic Charities of Baltimore, and Molly McGrath-Tierney, former director of Baltimore City's Department of Social Services. Then we ask Salvadoran reporter and former diplomat Hector Silva Avalos about why these migrant children are coming now and whether the surge will subside. Plus, Baltimore writer Susan Solemn's father had a secret she didn't learn until after he died. He had helped track down billions of dollars worth of precious art and valuables stolen by the Nazis during World War II. She tells us her father's story. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. The airwaves and newspapers recently have been full of reports about proposals to bring some of the unaccompanied children who cross the U.S. border to Maryland. You've also undoubtedly heard reports of the opposition to those proposals. The coverage may have created the impression that it would be unusual to house unaccompanied children in Maryland, or that it would require a big decision by the state or federal government. Actually, the Unaccompanied Alien Children Program, part of the U.S. Department of Human Services, reports that during the first 6 months of this year, 2,205 unaccompanied alien children came to Maryland. Sponsors in the state took responsibility for them. Joining us to explain how the system works and give some ideas about how it should work now that so many unaccompanied children have shown up is Molly McGrath-Tierney, former director of Baltimore City's Department of Social Services, now a management consultant. Welcome back to the show,
Thanks.
Molly.
Great to see you, Sheila.
And with us by phone is Bill McCarthy, director of Catholic Charities of Baltimore, which has been in the news lately for offering to house about 50 unaccompanied children at St. Vincent's Villa in Timonium. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, thank you, Sheila.
So, Bill, Catholic Charities runs a center for immigrant families, the Esperanza Center in Fells Point, Baltimore. What are you seeing there compared to what you normally see?
What we've seen of late is a greater number of unaccompanied youth that have been released from shelters on the border coming to us for reunification with families. Last year, when we started fingerprinting and assisting sponsors and family members in the reunification with children, we may have seen 20 to 25 combination of youth and sponsors per month. And in the month of July alone, we have had 81 children and 76 sponsors coming for assistance and service.
So,
and in a two-month period prior to that, the total was 225.
So it's like triple or quadruple what you're normally seeing.
Exactly.
And the federal government says 2,205 unaccompanied children in the first 6 months of this year were, quote, discharged to sponsors in Maryland, close quote. What does that mean? Who is a sponsor?
A sponsor is typically, in the best case, a family member, a mother, a father, an aunt, an uncle, an older sibling. But a sponsor could also be a friend, a neighbor, perhaps from the country of origin that knows these children and knows the family as well.
Molly, how long would you expect children in that situation to stay in that placement, to be in a facility or stay with a family?
Right. Well, it's pretty tough to say. You know, the way to think about this is sort of what happens right when a kid comes across the border, sort of in the first 30 days, and then what happens after that. And what has happened and so important that Bill and his colleagues at Catholic Charities have stepped forward is typically kids are coming across the border and staying in, they're being detained in federal facilities that are designed to hold adults.
Right.
And the country's sort of waking up and realizing, well, that just is not a reasonable way to a place to keep children. Bill and some of his colleagues across the country have places that are more well designed to keep children. And the idea is that for the first 30 days that they're here, an organization like Bill's would make sure that a kid was in a more child-friendly environment and then do the work to find a sponsor family, either someone to whom the kid was related or some very kind person who was willing to open their home. That labor happens in the first 30 days. After that, the kid goes and joins this family in the community for the duration of time it takes for the federal court to process either their status as a refugee or deportation. And that is a little up for grabs, knowing the federal courts are pretty backed up now. I don't know, Bill, if you have a sense of how long that's taking.
No, and I think, to your point, Molly, that's taking longer and longer as the number of cases have increased, you know, by multiple amounts.
But, Bill, these are kids who came, for the most part, without their parents. What does your experience tell you about how likely they are to have some kind of family in the U.S.?
Based on the Office of Refugee and Resettlement's experience over the years, there's about 95 placement of children with sponsors or family members.
I'm sorry, 95 placement?
95%. And then there's a shelter program similar to the one that we're proposing in Vienna, Virginia, that has an experience of 98% placements.
So you expect the great majority of the children we're reading about have some kind of family connection in the United States?
Yes.
On Maryland Morning 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast, speaking about Maryland's response to the tens of thousands of unaccompanied children crossing U.S. borders without documents. And with me in the studio is Molly McGrath-Tierney, former head of Baltimore City's Department of Social Services, and on the phone, Bill McCarthy, head of Maryland's Catholic Charities, which offers services to immigrants at several locations. Bill, how do newly arrived unaccompanied kids come to be at the Esperanza Center?
Typically, as Molly described earlier, they're detained at the border once they come and placed in a shelter there. And at this point, during the 30-day period, the process is done of finding a family member or a sponsor. And then the child is united with the sponsor in Baltimore. And then they come to the Center for Services, whether it's legal consultation, health care, educational assessment, school readiness, English classes, and other services, and also social services that this family needs in order to provide the appropriate care for the children and the family.
And if you were staffed up to do that a year ago for, I think you said, maybe 25 kids a month on average,
yeah,
how do you cope as the numbers rise so much?
That's a fair point. Where a lot of the focus has been on the placement of children and the sheltering of children or the foster care placement of children, what has been missing and what we fear being lost is the strain that it is being placed on the community resources to support these children and to support these families. We are in the process of looking at hiring additional staff, recruiting additional pro bono volunteer lawyers to help with cases, and our health clinic looking at some additional practitioners to volunteer their time and services. I think it's a real strain, and I think we're just at the beginning of this, so the strain is only going to get greater.
Well, Molly, these kids are essentially in federal custody. I mean, they
yes,
are accused of having violated federal law.
Correct.
So the federal government has custody of them. Will the federal government cover all these costs that Bill just describe to us?
Well, I think that it's reasonable to expect that the federal government's figuring out how do we cover the cost of the first 30 days? Like, how do we get them sheltered and make sure someone like Bill and his colleagues has the resources to find the kid's family or a sponsor family for them? I think Bill's point is apt. It's the timing after that for the duration of the wait for due process in court that there's some questions about how that will all get supported.
Bill, how do you expect to come up with the money?
Well, we're hopeful, obviously, support from government, but our support from our benefactors, and, of course, using our resources to help meet this need. This is what we do. This is our obligation as a human service agency. This is our obligation as a civil society to provide care and support for these children and families.
We have heard from some public officials like Republican Delegate Wade Koch, who is running for the Baltimore County Council, say that settling these kids in Maryland for any length of time is a mistake. Delegate Koch raised concerns about the health of these kids. He told WBAL Radio that if kids come to Maryland, they should be housed in federal facilities.
If we're going to do that, we need to make certain that public hearings, public informational sessions are held in the communities concerned so that so many of these unanswered questions can be addressed.
Bill McCarthy, how do you respond to officials worried like Delegate Koch?
Yes, I think part of it is education and understanding whether the delegate understands or appreciates this or not, the children are here. And so the children also need to be cared for. Also, if you look at the proposals of the use of federal facilities for the housing or sheltering of children, none of them really met the needs or would be helpful or beneficial to the children. What we were proposing, and we are proposing, and what we are going to do, which was what the delegate was responding to, is completely different. We are going to house 50 children at St. Vincent's Villa on a 250-acre campus in Timonium. That's history. It was designed for and always been used for the residential care for children.
Molly,
I
was going to ask Molly McGrath Tierney, in your 7 years as head of social services in Baltimore City, I know you were passionate about getting kids out of institutions mm-hmm. into homes, mm-hmm. but when there are tens of thousands of kids suddenly needing a placement, isn't it inevitable that some large facilities are going to be needed?
I doubt it. I gotta say, I appreciate the delegate's position about children should be housed in a federal facility, but I feel like this is a really important time for our community to slice through some of this rhetoric. A federal facility that houses people is, to Bill's point, a prison. That's the only thing it is. And, you know, our experience in the care of kids in foster care here in Baltimore City was they just don't do really well in institutions like that. They, especially the younger ones. And the story of the children that are coming across the border, these are kids that are coming from terrible circumstances, who have had a very frightening journey, who, you know, they want to go to school. And they want three squares a day, and they're not, this is not a set of hardened criminals that are coming to invade our state.
Thank you both. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Molly McGrath Tierney is former head of Baltimore City's Department of Social Services. She's now with the management consultant firm Bennett Midland. Bill McCarthy heads Catholic Charities in Maryland, which offers services to immigrants at several locations. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the undocumented child migrants who are leaving Central America to try to enter the United States. An estimated 57,000 children have crossed the border since last fall. Maryland is more than 1,700 miles from the Mexican border, but we have a strong connection with one of the Central American countries. More foreign-born Marylanders have come from El Salvador than any other country. Many of them are concentrated in Langley Park at the northwest edge of Prince George's County between College Park and Silver Spring. Joining us now to talk about what's driving Salvadoran children to enter the United States is Hector Silva Avalos. He's a Salvadoran reporter and research fellow at American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies. He's also a former deputy chief of mission at the Salvadoran Embassy in Washington, and he joins us by cell phone from San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've heard that gang violence in Central America is one of the main factors driving these kids to try to enter the U.S. What other factors are there from your reporting?
Gang violence is definitely something that has to be taken into consideration, but also a migration trend that's been going on for at least three decades now of Salvadorans fleeing to the United States because of economic reasons. And that's definitely something that's been driving this the Salvadoran migration to the United States all this time. And the other thing, referring particularly to the situation of the unaccompanied minors that, you know, was brought to the people's attention by President Obama last month, is the, a legal situation within the United States that because of a legal reform that Congress passed in 2008, U.S. Border Patrol agents are not allowed to immediately deport unaccompanied minors coming from other countries than Mexico. So that means that these minors, the Central American minors, have to go through an immigration process that's pretty complex. And the immigration courts in the U.S. are very badly backlogged. So this could take years before these minors are deported from the United States.
What I don't understand, Hector, is that, as you mentioned, the change of deportation procedures stems from a law that is 6 years old, and certainly the economy in those countries didn't just turn bad. Why the big surge now?
Well, I think what we're witnessing now is some sort of, you know, those three tides coming together in some sort of perfect storm until now. And then with the legal part, I think what happened is that the smugglers, the coyotes, the organizations that illegally take these kids from Central America to the United States took a while to understand that there was some sort of breach in the system that could allow them to say to parents, both in the United States and in Central America, we have now a way for your kids to get into the United States. They were telling the kids, listen, you don't have to go through the desert now or to the Rio Grande Valley. You just need to present yourself to a U.S. agent at the border and identify yourself as a Central American minor, and they won't deport you immediately. So what they were telling the parents is they won't deport your kids, period. They weren't telling the parents that the process was still going on, that was still in place, the deportation process, but that is going to be delayed due to this legal reform. So it took a while for them to figure out how to, find this sidebar.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Hector Silva Avalos. He's a Salvadoran reporter and research fellow at American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies. He's also a former El Salvadoran diplomat at the embassy in Washington. Hector, you wrote recently for an El Salvadoran newspaper about a woman whom you called Sandra, not her real name. She lives in Langley Park in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. Her 16-year-old daughter recently left El Salvador and joined her here in Maryland. Briefly, tell us her story.
Yes, Sandra, she's Salvadoran. She went to the United States 7 years ago. She now works in the Maryland, in the neighborhoods around Wheaton, Langley Park, Silver Spring, in Montgomery County. She cleans houses, and twice a week she takes care of the people's kids. She said, one of the main reasons I am here is because I want something better for them. I knew that when I came here, I wasn't going to be able to provide that here. So I left her with her kids with her sister. But I knew that was my goal from the first time I arrived. So I worked hard, saved enough money to bring them. And now that she has the money, she decided to bring her eldest kid, who's this girl that's 16 years old. And she got another two here. She's thinking about bringing the middle kid, this boy. She's going to save the money to bring him, and she's having a lot of thoughts about the younger girl because, she's very worried about what. Specifically, she said, "I don't want her to get raped in the journey." So, and she's so little, so I will wait another while to take her here. But her goal is to have her two kids with her in Maryland.
Do you think that it's likely, from your reporting, do you think Sandra and her daughter will follow through on going to immigration court?
I actually don't think so. And I think that, especially in the state of Maryland, they know that the state of Maryland is welcoming. I mean, that is, it's a good place to be. They say that the first point of destination of the southern community in the D.C. area was precisely the District of Columbia. And they moved. But they moved first to Virginia, to the northern counties in Virginia, Fairfax, Arlington. But then, since things became more tougher in Virginia in terms of the law and in the political approach of Virginia politicians to the immigration issue, that drove another wave of people to Maryland. My view, my take is that the girl, she won't be presenting herself to court. That's my view. Of course, I didn't ask either of them.
And you think that based on other stories other reporting you've done of Salvadoran immigrants in the Washington area?
I think it's pretty safe to say that they rather live on the ground as undocumented in an illegal situation rather than risk it and go to court and risk it to be deported back here. And when it happens, and you talk to these kids or adults in the border or here in El Salvador, and you ask them, are you planning going back? And they say, of course. And I will go back a second time or a third time. Are you aware? And when you said or you asked, are you aware that if you re-enter after you've been deported, that's a felony? And say, of course, I know that. But I will, again, rather go there and face that situation than stay here.
Hector, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hector Silva Avalos is a Salvadoran reporter and research fellow at American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies. He's also a former deputy chief of mission at the Embassy of El Salvador in Washington. He joined us via cell phone from San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, a Baltimore writer on her father's role after World War II, tracking down valuables seized by Nazis. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
Want to get into the war?
Monuments, man.
Time to put a team together and do our best to protect buildings, bridges, and art before the Nazis destroy everything.
How many men?
Six.
Jesus.
Well, with you at seven.
That's much better.
Matt Damon and George Clooney in a scene from the recent film Monuments Men. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Monuments Men, the film, was based on a true story. In anticipation of the U.S. of the Allies winning World War II, the U.S. commissioned a platoon to rescue stolen art and other personal and cultural treasures plundered by the Nazis. Monuments Men, as they were known, were part of what's been called the greatest treasure hunt in history, an effort to save Europe's culture. Joel Fisher played a big role in that mission. A U.S. Department of Treasury lawyer who enlisted in the Coast Guard, Fisher was assigned to General Dwight Eisenhower's Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force in 1944. The young lieutenant commander with Treasury experience was made chief of the Foreign Exchange and Property Control Section in G5, the headquarters financial division. When American forces got wind that the Nazis were hiding treasures, Lieutenant Commander Fisher led part of the hunt. Then after the war, he almost never spoke of it. He built a career as a lawyer. His daughter, Susan Sullum, longtime press secretary for U.S. Senator Ben Cardin, now a Baltimore-based writer, didn't know any of the story until nearly a decade after her father died. Susan Sullum wrote about that discovery last month in the Washington Post magazine, and she's with me now in the studio to share the story with us. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
How did you learn about this chapter in your father's life?
Well, it's been quite a journey. I had been contacted by a historian who urged me to file for my father's personnel records, which I did.
Did he say why?
He had seen my father's obit online in the New York Times. He knew he was on Eisenhower's staff. And he he had originally contacted me 9 years ago and asked me to go through his files if I had any, but I was too busy. I took his name. I told him I'd be in touch with him, and then I never did. A year ago, in March of 2013, he contacted me and said, George Clooney's doing a movie on this. I really urge you to at least file for your father's personnel records. Well, I thought that would be easy enough. I filed, and I kept getting information that they couldn't find him, any record of him having served. I finally got a call in June of 2013 saying, we have no record of your dad. Is it possible you have a service ID number for him? And then the woman, the lieutenant in the Coast Guard said, by the way, there are times when people file for their parents or service records, and they find out that they never served in the military. So by then, I was very alarmed. I went down to my basement with this really dorky headlight on, went through my files that I had saved from my dad's office, and I found hundreds and hundreds of pages.
These were files you had taken?
I had taken after my dad had died in 1997. I had removed them from a storage facility in Northern Virginia and brought what I could fit into my minivan up to my Baltimore basement, where they sat undisturbed for 15 years. I finally went down there, and I found hundreds of pages of top secret, classified, restricted documents, along with newspaper clippings of interviews he had given after the war about all this. So going through this material, I found out his birth certificate, the name on his birth certificate was Joseph, not Joel, which was why they could not find him.
They found him then as Joseph? They
yes.
Found his file?
Yes. And I did eventually get his entire file. So it was interesting.
So tell us what he did. I mean, first of all, set the scene. When in the war and where was he doing what he did?
My father wanted to join the Army or Navy. He was rejected for bad eyesight and flat feet. He finally was able to get a commission as an ensign into the Coast Guard. He was assigned to Eisenhower's staff in 1944 because he had an expertise in finance. He'd been a lawyer with the Treasury Department. When Patton began his sweep into Germany, they found this unbelievable catch in what is called the Merkers Mine. They found
Merkers is a town, a city.
It was a mining village in southern and eastern Germany. It was referred to as a salt mine. They had these potassium mine network of them, and the Nazis had at the beginning of 1945 had moved a lot of their plundered loot to these salt mines in eastern and southern Germany, along with Reich banks, and they. This, when they went into the Merkers mine the first time, they discovered one room. It's called room number 8. It was 150 feet long by 75 feet wide. It was filled with 7,000 bags of gold and silver and currency.
You describe
yes.
How your father, you quoted from your an interview your father did with the Washington Post.
Yes.
When he first entered that mine. Would you read that for us?
It was very interesting. He said, quote, "The first thing that greeted us were open boxes filled with wedding rings, gold teeth inlays, and gold and silver picture frames. The owners, we were informed by German guards, were dead. Right in the middle of the cold, white salt beds were these wooden crates. I got a hold of something sharp and pried one open, and there was one of those beautiful paintings." So my father was then given the task of inventorying all the salt mines and all the Reich banks in the region. And he led a team of 75 men that, in the course of 3 weeks, traveled 1,900 miles and recovered 6.6 tons of gold and 198,000 pounds of silver. It was a remarkable story, and one he never talked about.
Well, let me pick up on that point.
Yeah.
Why do you think he didn't talk about it? He did give some interviews.
He did
the Washington Post interview.
War, he gave an interview with CBS Radio, Report to the Nation. He did a New York Times interview, some magazine interviews. I think that was right after the war when the government wanted to discuss what had been found and how the Nazis were trying to hide all this plundered wealth. I think he didn't discuss it because I think, like many soldiers, he wanted to put the war behind him. It was like history. He just wanted to move on with his life. And I think there was a need psychologically for many soldiers who participated in the war to do that and to move on with their lives, which he did.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with writer Susan Sullum. We're talking about her discovery that her father played a role in retrieving Nazi loot after World War II, recovering stolen art and currency from the Nazis. She wrote about it in the Washington Post magazine this summer. So the files that you had in your basement for 15 years before
yes.
you looked at them,
yes.
what you thought they were just legal files of some sort?
Yeah, you know, along with them, there were files that we'd taken on his health records, his finance. You know, I had no idea. I put them in a filing cabinet and totally forgot about them in my unfinished basement. And I had no idea that he had had these experiences. And it's amazing to me and my siblings and people who knew my father that he never did talk about it. He was a very expansive person who loved to talk about how he once dated Dinah Shore. He was friends with William O. Douglas. He had a very prominent legal career in Washington, D.C. But this, he just never talked about. He once referenced to me after Patton, the movie, came out. It was in 1970, and he once talked about it. And he said, he was talking about Patton and what a difficult general he was. And he said, I remember when we were rushing to get to the salt mines in Weimar, and Patton stopped us and gave us a really hard time, but finally said, I have to let you go because you're Ike's boys. I never asked, salt mines? Why are we rushing to the salt mines? What's in the salt mines? I was a kid, you know. It never occurred to me.
What you've learned now, why was it so urgent? I mean, you talk about three weeks.
Yes, that's very interesting. The Yalta Agreement had given that entire portion to Russian control. Now, they found the village of Merkers in the first salt mine was found on April 8th, was first entered. The war ended May 8th, so they had 1 month to retrieve all of that plundered loot. In one Reichsbank, my father found Himmler, the chief of the SS, had deposited a ton of gold coins, 35 bags of gold coins. The year before, another bank, he found the entire silver reserve of Hungary. Another bank, he found two tons of gold from Holland. I mean, it just went on and on and on. It's as if the Nazis marched into the U.S. and absolutely looted Fort Knox. But they did that with every country they occupied.
What you said, there were some things that didn't make it into your Washington Post article that he found.
Well, let's see.
The patents.
Oh, yes. I was telling you about that before we started. I found a memo from General Frank McSherry saying in one of the salt mines they had found 30 railroad car load of patent records. They were really the entire patent records or patents of all of Europe. And the historian who originally contacted me on this quest, about this quest, I talked to him about it, and he said, if these hadn't been found, there would still be litigation over these patents going on today. So it was an enormous find. And in fact, General McSherry in his memo said, this is of immense value to the industrialists of the world. So that was amazing.
And you talked about tons of gold
yes.
that your father's task force found. What happened with that gold?
Well, it's interesting. After the war, there was something called the Tripartite Commission for the Restitution of Monetary Gold. It was formed to distribute to the countries whose central banks had been looted by the Nazis to redistribute the loot that had been plundered. It took quite some time because of the Cold War. Some of these countries were behind the Iron Curtain. But then there was the Russian in the 19, early 1990s, the Russian regime fell and sort of opened up and ended the Cold War. And the Gold Conference, there was a Gold Conference in London in 1997, which was the year my father died, in which the European countries that in which their gold had been looted agreed to relinquish their claims to the remaining $60 million in gold held by the Tripartite Commission and donate it to a Nazi persecution fund to help Holocaust victims and their survivors. So to a fund to help the victims and their survivors of the Holocaust.
So it took essentially five decades.
Yes, it did.
To settle that question. How did all of this, all of these revelations change the way you look at your father?
Well, I'm still continue to be puzzled that he never talked about it. It was not his personality not to talk about something like this. I admire him. I think he threw himself into this wholeheartedly. I think it was the most important thing he probably did in his whole life. And at the same time, I think he had a need to step away from it after the war was over and to get on with his life. And while I find it an amazing puzzle, I have to admire what he did.
I really appreciate your telling us about it. I hope we get to learn more about this. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Writer Susan Sullum. We've got a link to her article published in the Washington Post magazine last month and information on where you can hear her speak about this in the fall. That's all on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. The program is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Tom Hall is our culture editor. We have production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. Coffee provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville on the web at zekescoffee.com. You can find us online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. You can leave a comment about something you heard or make a suggestion about an interview you think you should hear on our show. On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Sheila Cass. The whole Maryland Morning team is glad you're listening. Have a great weekend.